happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor and founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine, which is now, believe it or not, celebrating its 15th year in existence. I thought we'd have a big blowout party this summer in Chicago at a Fretboard Summit. That is clearly not happening, but we can maybe celebrate virtually via this podcast and our website and everything else. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to two people I know very well, and you probably know their bylines very well if you've read guitar magazines over the years. Taya Gerken and Doug Young have been in Acoustic Guitar Magazine countless times. Taya has written for us over the years as well. He is now over at Peghead Nation, teaching thousands of musicians how to be better at their craft. And these guys recorded a duets record, which they simply called Duets this year. We recorded this podcast earlier this year, back in late February, early March. So in the middle of the pandemic, but nothing like where we're at today. But this interview definitely holds up, and their record certainly holds up. It has all sorts of beautiful moments, as well as all sorts of beautiful guitars on it. We're going to be talking about that in a few minutes. I think you will truly love it. Thank you for all the feedback on the last few episodes of the Fretboard Journal podcast. Please keep them coming. Please keep sharing episodes if you love them. And please leave us reviews over on Apple Podcasts. We've had some fun episodes recently. We have some fun ones on the horizon, too. I just got off the phone with Michael Millard of Froggy Bottom Guitars, who's celebrating his 50th anniversary. Puts us to shame. This is a good one. You're going to like it. That's going to be out in a couple of weeks. So subscribe to our podcast if you haven't yet. Here at the Fretboard Journal, we are shipping the Fretboard Journal's second electric guitar annual, and it is going fast. So if you've loved our magazine, if you feel like you've owned everything I've ever put out, now is your final warning to order the Fretboard Journal's electric guitar annual. This was not included in Fretboard Journal subscriptions because I know our readers, not everybody wants a whole magazine dedicated to electric guitars. A bunch of you would get upset. So we redesigned it. It's its own thing. It's like its own little coffee table book that's not part of the numbered Fretboard Journal editions, but it is a good issue, a good anthology. Never before read stories on everything from Jack White and the Raconteurs to the restoration of a Fender Esquire, the very first guitar that Paul Bigsby ever built. A story I did on all the luthiers and amp builders who were supported by Walter Becker of Steely Dan over the years. And perhaps the story that's closest to my heart, because I was really into him when I was younger, we interviewed Ian Mackay of Fugazi on the Gibson White SG that he has had for so many years and used exclusively through his Fugazi run. That's a story not unlike the story we did on Tony Rice's Clarence White guitar. It's a big love letter to one guitar, and I love stories like that, and so I was really happy that Ned Oldham did it for us. I think you will dig it too. Check that out. Go to fretboardjournal.com, click on the shop tab. It's also a great time to subscribe right now because we're putting the finishing touches on Fretboard Journal 46. It's going to be we're going to be hitting the send button to the printer soon. So that's going to be out in about a month, and we would love for you to receive it. We are a reader-supported magazine, barely any advertising on this podcast, in our magazine, on our website, because we have enough subscribers who help us do what we want to do. I have big plans for the rest of the year. I think we have a fourth podcast addition to our little podcast family. We already have this one. We've got Luthier on Luthier, which you should definitely check out if you're listening to this episode. And then we have the other podcast that I do, The Truth About Vintage Amps, where I co-host that with Skip Simmons. We have so many listeners to that podcast who don't even own amplifiers. It's just a big, fun weekly chat about all things DIY and craft and maintaining your sanity. So tune into that one. And then, like I said, I think we have a fourth one in the works. We are still growing. We are still firing on all cylinders, even though we're still kind of working remotely from home, all because of you. So thank you for supporting the Fretboard Journal and all that we do. We do have a couple of sponsors, Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags and backpacks, studio monitor stands. Everything they do is just really ergonomic, really simple, and really bulletproof. So check out all that they are up to. Go to monocreators.com. Our other sponsor, of course, is our friends over in New York City at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. Every week on this podcast, I scour their new arrivals page to see what they have that's cool. It doesn't take me long. They have so much cool stuff. It's like a museum where you can buy everything. If you've been reading the Fretboard Journal for a while, you probably remember back in issue 33, 34, we did a story on Buzzato guitars, which are the other vintage gypsy jazz guitar alongside Selmer Mockaferry's. And guess what? They have a late 30s Buzzato Grand Model gypsy jazz guitar in stock right now. These things are so beautiful. They're so, I mean, you can just see how many late night jams outdoors these guitars have had. And this thing looks like a piece of folk art, and I bet it sounds like heaven. Check that out if you've ever wanted a vintage gypsy jazz guitar in your arsenal. They also have a very cool guitar that I've never even seen before, a mid-60s Gretsch Model 6117 custom made for the Sam Ash guitar stores, which at the time were only in New York City. It's a black guitar with the cat eye F-holes. So cool. Everything they have is so cool. They must reject a lot of guitars because everything they have, I want. Go to retrofret.com. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. What else can I tell you? Not much else. Again, we're talking to Taya Gerken and Doug Young. Their record is called Duets. We've interviewed a bunch of people this year on this podcast who've put out amazing records. Sarah Jaros, Trey Burt, these guys. I've been totally enamored with an album that came out from a podcast guest from a few years ago, Christian Lee Hudson. Check out his record, Beginners, if you're into the sounds of Elliott Smith or Randy Newman. It is breathtakingly beautiful. All right, I'm rambling. Here's Taya Gerken and Doug Young. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want to have info on their record, I'll put a link in the show notes.
It's a weird time to put out a new record, but here we are.
Here we are. Yeah. And you know what? I've struggled with this as well. Like, we're obviously trying to keep the magazine going and the podcast going. And I will say, like, you know, listening to your music and preparing for this, it was actually, you know, it did what music was supposed to do. It transported me, and it was soothing and felt good. And so the show must go on, at least for some of us.
Right.
You know, because it's important.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely it. And well, and we are all three kind of fortunate in that, at least in terms of our professional lives, this isn't going to have the kind of impact that it has on a lot of people, including, you know, a lot of our artist friends. I mean, I really feel for a lot of those people. I mean, I just got a text from Tim Sparks this morning. You know, he had a 15-day tour in Germany and Italy starting mid-April. And, of course, you know, it's all gone. And,
well, sure.
I mean, everybody. It's just one of so many. It's crazy.
Yeah. So, well, how did you two meet before we talk about the Duets record?
Wow, that's a good Do you remember?
Well, that's the funny thing. Neither one of us can exactly remember how we met. I think it was definitely through our work at Acoustic Guitar Magazine back in the day. I don't know, Doug, I think you just started querying us with some either lessons or wanting to do gear reviews. We certainly started working together back when I was the gear editor at Acoustic Guitar. I would send Doug guitars to review. And, you know, we sort of started what's really kind of a professional relationship that way. And that morphed into, you know, inviting each other to play at some gigs, and then realizing that, not only did we like to geek out on guitars together, we also liked a lot of the same guitar music.
I think the first article I wrote for Acoustic Guitar that I submitted was an introduction to Dadgad, and it was at the time that I was thinking about doing the Mel Bay book that I eventually did. So I thought, well, this could start an article. And I must have met you somewhere before, but I sent it in to you and Scott, And as I recall, you sent it back almost entirely covered in red ink. And oh, you'll have to redo it. And so it was a learning experience for me. And in fact, I thought after that article, I'd never hear from you again. But but in the end, it's
funny.
And I learned a lot about writing from the process and ended up going on and writing quite a lot for the magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Doug and I both hosted long-running fingerstyle guitar showcases. I did one in San Francisco at the Bazaar Cafe that had a 12-year run every month. And Doug, you hosted them in a couple of different places in the South Bay.
Yeah, we kept closing places, I guess. finding venues in the South Bay that can maintain acoustic music and stay open has been a challenge. But I always thought your setup there in San Francisco was great, but I wanted one that I didn't have to travel so far to, and that I could have South Bay musicians participate in. So we had a nice run. Did it for 10 or 11 years every month and had 100 different musicians play.
Wow. So basically, you know, we there was the same format. We each hosted, it was basically a round robin of three fingerstyle guitar players. And, you know, I would probably invite Doug a couple of times a year to play mine. He'd invite me to play his. And eventually that sort of turned into, you know, let's learn to play some tunes together. And then that morphed into, hey, you know, we could actually be a duet, not just sort of sit in on each other's stuff. And then we started working out some material, and that was sort of the beginning of all that.
Nice. You guys, and then what about the making of this record? When did you decide to hunker down and do it? And you did it at Doug's? Doug, you have a studio?
Yes, my converted garage, yes.
Okay.
It's a very nice converted garage studio, though.
It's a Bay Area converted garage studio. It's probably worth a lot.
It is nice. It's got a colorful history in that we built it for my my son for his rock band. When he started in junior high, the band was over here, and they lined the garage with Marshall stacks and drums, and the neighbors were lined up at our front door saying, is this going to go on very long? And we decided if we were going to keep the kids at home, we were going to need to do something. So we built basically a room in the garage, double insulated the outside walls. And I got free 14-year-old labor to to build the walls. And then when my son grew up and moved on, I inherited his space. But I made it a bit nicer than when he was there.
Nice.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, actually, the very first kind of impetus of let's do this more formally really was Doug and I both had an idea when I was still at Acoustic Guitar for an article on fingerstyle duets. And so we arranged a couple of pieces that ended up running in that, and one of them being Saint Anne's Reel, which we recorded on the record. And that was kind of like, hey, you know, we can do this and have a little bit of a method to it that's beyond just jamming on some stuff. And but that's probably, I don't know, Doug, I think that was like in 2012 or something like that. So it took us a long time. In the meanwhile, you know, I was laid off from Acoustic Guitar. I started Peghead Nation. I have a family. So I had a lot of stuff going on in the last few years that sort of delayed the whole thing. Plus, Doug lives in the South Bay. I'm up here in Marin County. So we have a good hour and a half between us. So finding time to do it isn't always something that that happens easily.
I think we probably recorded the first tracks early last year, January, February, maybe March. I don't know.
But we did some other stuff before that we didn't keep.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And you guys pulled out all the stops on the guitar quiver. Was there
We actually didn't pull out all the stops, but we pulled out all the stops.
was that one of the original thoughts behind this project? Was let's showcase a variety of different actual guitars and how they are constructed?
Doug, do you want to say something about that?
I'd say not so much. It just sort of happened. I mean, we've been trying to use different colors and different guitars, even when we play together live. The only hassle there is, you know, dragging a lot of guitars to the gig. But we started early on trying to say, how can we expand the range of two guitars you know, with the baritone, and I've got this little high-strung 12-string and different guitars. So we've tried to be changing things up all along. When we actually set out to record, I didn't even think about it. The first four or five tunes we recorded, I used the same guitar. And then at some point, right. I was like, oh, you know, we ought to change this up just for variety.
Yeah.
First handful was an Ed Claxton EM. It's the guitar okay. That's on the cover of the CD.
Got it.
Yeah, I think ultimately, you know, neither one of us, we didn't set out and say, hey, let's record a bunch of guitars. Because I think even though, you know, Doug and I's sort of friendship and relationship definitely started out sort of geeking out over all these guitars that we were reviewing and stuff, I think both tend to think more about the music and the arrangements than the sounds of the particular guitars necessarily. And I think that, you know, that is something important to keep in mind for anyone, is that, you know, it's about the playing. It's not about the instrument. It's not, the album is not called 12 Great Guitars Played by Teja and Doug. I mean, but we do happen to each have a lot of guitars, and it was a lot of fun to kind of find out, you know, which ones would match nicely. And especially, I think the baritone worked out really nicely in there. You know, I played National on one. And I think that the coolest thing really is the baritone and the mini Yamamoto 12-string that we used in a couple of tracks.
Yeah, those were two guitars. I watched the YouTube video. Both of those luthiers were not on my radar. For folks who don't know, can you describe those two guitars?
Sure. The baritone is built by a guy, Mario DeSeo, and he's up here in Richmond, California, and he's still kind of under the radar. I first met him at the Bazaar Cafe in San Francisco, not because he was a player in my showcase, but he was a singer-songwriter. He was in the band called Mario Speedwagon when I met him. And
you didn't hold that against
him. He's a classic case of a guy who got really serious about buying guitars on eBay and everything, and then he had a kid, and his wife said, "You can't buy any more guitars," and he said, "Okay, I'll start building them," and he did. And the first, you know, dozen or so were nice efforts, and then they started sounding really, really good. He built like a ton of kind of slope shoulder dreadnoughts, J45 style guitars, and you know, some of them, even though the craftsmanship was still a little bit rough, they just sounded great. And he managed to get all these really good Bay Area sort of singer-songwriters playing his guitars. Maurice Tani has one, Jeff Pearson has one, Deborah Crooks has one, Mokai has one. So there are a bunch of performing musicians who have his guitars. So he approached me. He really wanted to build me a guitar because he knew about my work at AG and everything. And I said, well, build me a baritone. And he'd never heard of one. But we kind of went through the specs, and we actually basically copied the body size of my Loudon 010. So it's kind of a, you know, small jumbo kind of thing. And I went up to Luthiers Mercantile and bought the woods and basically delivered them to him. And it took him almost 2 years to build the guitar. And it was his first and up to this time only baritone that he's built. But I really lucked out. It's a really great sounding guitar.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that guitar.
It was super fun.
With the Yamamoto, Tony was for a long time living in Dublin, and kind of the same thing. He's kind of an unknown, under the radar builder, but kind of a cult favorite here in the Bay Area. And an awful lot of Bay Area guitar players have his guitars. He was really good about. He would go out to every show and bring a guitar. And he would build them quite fast, and he was pretty inexpensive relative to the quality that he got. So he would go out to people's shows and always have a new guitar in tow and try to get people to play it. And so, therefore, a lot of us ended up with them. And he's also incredibly adventurous. So he has a couple nice six-string models and so on. But he built me a seven-string. He built me a baritone 12-string. And then with this little guitar, he saw me playing a Let Griffin short scale double chorus guitar. And he said, I think I could build you something that'd be kind of interesting in that line, but let's design it together. And so it turned out that's a truly custom guitar, as opposed to, you know, you often go to a luthier and they're going to build you their guitar, but maybe you pick the woods or something like that. No, this was everything. The dimensions, what scale is it? What's the string format on it? We tried both unison strung and 12-string strung. And it's so it basically ends up being a guitar that's the equivalent of a 12-string that's capoed at the 5th fret. And when it's open. And, you know, we had to play around with string spacing and so on. The one I used on the CD is the third one he built. Or maybe it's the fourth, now that I think about it. We went through a couple prototypes. And you know, he would just bring them over, drop them off, and then I'd send them back, and he'd try a different thing.
Got it. And how are you tuning that?
Well, I usually have it tuned to dadgad, except up a fourth, so up to G.
Okay. For folks who aren't in your league of playing, such as myself and probably most of the people listening to this, when you approach arrangements, and some of these tunes are original and some of them have kind of been around forever, what comes first? Do you lock in on the tuning first? Walk us through how these songs kind of evolve from, hey, let's try to see if this one works as a duet.
Well, there were a few different approaches, really. We started out playing tunes that we were already playing as solo pieces. Probably the first tune we did was a tune of mine called Her Red Hair, which is a tune that was also on my first solo CD, and I've been playing it for a long time. It's a tune that is in G minor tuning, and basically Doug just came up with a second part for it, so it wasn't really written or arranged as a duet from the very beginning. But Doug, we really tried to arrange things in a way that that interlocked the guitar parts more than, say, okay, you play rhythm, I play lead kind of a thing. That was really sort of an overarching goal on this whole thing, to kind of come up with that kind of arrangement. And we really kind of looked, you know, like the classic sort of duet records, like the John Renborn and Burt Jansz record is so great. We really liked the record that Steve Boffman and Robin Bullock put out a few years ago. So Doug came up with a second part in dadgad tuning. So I don't know if you want to talk about how you approach that, Doug.
Yeah, you know, I don't think the tuning matters too much to us. We haven't, and there's probably a few cases where we specifically picked the tuning, but I recall working that tune out and I just sort of sat down and did it by ear. And I'm often playing in dadgad, so I just naturally picked up a guitar in dadgad and I said, oh, he's in G minor, but I bet this will work. And, you know, all the notes are there no matter what tuning you're in. And so just more or less by ear, I came up with alternate parts and harmonies and things, and it worked. G minor is actually kind of a nice key in dadgad, so it worked out fine.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of tunes that are, I think, pretty interesting the way we arranged them. One is there's a tune of Doug's called The Seagull, that we recorded before on Doug's solo record, and I played on it, but we completely rearranged it. So that was kind of a fun process because we just didn't want it to be the same, but we wanted to use the tune. So that was actually a tune where on the original recording, I played a regular guitar, I played my Martin OM in standard tuning. On this recording, I'm playing a National with a slide in C G C D G D tuning with a capo on the second fret. And I tried, I basically worked out the arrangement in like four different tunings to see what would sound best. This is really the only time I was that methodical. I tried it in that. I tried it in Orkney with no capo to get into the right key. I tried it in the open D tune. So I tried with different tunings and different capo positions, just the open strings and kind of the slide positions that would work. And I think we even, Doug, didn't we try it with and without a capo for you so it would put me in different keys? I mean, we really worked this one out.
Yeah, the original one was in E, and I played a capo too. So we dropped it down to... And I'm playing it on a 12-string instead of a 6-string. So we right. definitely or a different key, a different feel, and different colors on that recording.
Yeah. So that was pretty fun. And the other tune that was kind of interesting that way is Travis, which is a Bela Fleck tune that we recorded, where we completely switched roles. I originally brought the tune to the project playing the main part, and we just couldn't really come up with a second part. And then I made some suggestions, and Doug ended up learning the main part, and I ended up playing the second part to it. So it was a good reminder that sometimes it's just good to be flexible and not get too locked into who's playing what.
And there we changed the tuning too. So you the tune, the way Bella plays it, is in Edgad, and that's what I'm doing, but you went with Orkney instead.
Right, I'm playing it in Orkney, which is basically a G-sus4 tuning, C, G, D, G, C, D, and I'm actually flat-picking it quite a bit. So really the idea is to expand the range in the way that, you know, a single guitar just couldn't do it. Like, even if you somehow had magic fingers and could play all the parts at once, you still wouldn't have all the strings necessary to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you obviously now are one of the people behind Paykit Nation, where you're giving instruction to people around the world. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's given recent events, I'm assuming there's probably a spike in people suddenly deciding as they hunker down that they need to focus on their playing and not leave the house so much. What advice do you guys have for all the people out there who might be trying, perhaps, unfortunately, with some lag time because Skype and FaceTime aren't perfect, but what advice do you have for people who want to try to duet for the first time? How do you, any steps people should take or thoughts about that?
Doug?
Well, you know, we worked out a lot of ours remotely just by mailing files back and forth.
Yeah.
So, Teo would record a rough take of something, send it my way, and I'd say, yeah, I can. Here's an idea I got to work with that. And, you know, we ultimately had to get together to work them out. But at least the initial sketches we certainly did remotely. I've done recordings with other people, by mailing files back and forth. It's actually not that common these days. So it kind of, when you do it that way, though, somebody's got to have somebody's got to lay down the basic thing. So, like, if we were to try to do another tune remotely like that, and if I were starting it, I'd probably need to come up with the song structure and, you know, have it nailed down and then mail a complete recording out, and then Taya could overdub his part on that, and we could bounce it back.
There was actually one tune that we recorded, Red Snapper, which Doug had also recorded before, and he actually played both parts on the original recording. So he had it all written out, and I basically just played the written part. But kind of to go back to your question, Jason, I think, if people just want to work out duets, ideally, when they're not social distancing like we are now, you know, even though we try to avoid the sort of classic rhythm and lead roles, that probably is the best way to just get a feel of something. You know, one player really learned the melody and the other one just really learned the accompanying part. And then once you have that foundation down, you can play with ways to switch roles or to build on that. That would probably be my main approach. Doing the different tunings definitely helps to open things up and just avoids that you sort of, you know, automatically get into the same territory. And the same is true for using capos. I mean, if, you know, the basic example is, you know, if one of you plays in standard tuning, playing, you know, E chord in the first position and the other is capo 2 when you play that same chord in a D shape further up, you're already creating a bigger sounding, more interesting, colorful arrangement than if you just completely double up. And it's just a way of sort of thinking about how far can you take those opportunities that the guitar really has. The capo is definitely your friend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We've Doug and I have a couple of times a couple of times we've taught workshops on just specifically playing duets. And I think, you know, those are the kind of things that we kind of got into. It's really, ultimately, it's no different if you're, you know, a guitar player accompanying, say, a singer-songwriter who's who's already got a part. You just have to find ways to sort of sneak your way in there without doubling up. The thing you really want to avoid in most cases is doing the same thing. And whether that's playing really sparse, whether that's playing some kind of harmony, whether it's playing with texture, you know, in some ways, you know, using all these different guitars, we kind of cheat it because, you know, when you play a guitar, a baritone guitar and a regular guitar, you kind of have an instant arrangement right there. But it's also just super fun to come up with these different tonalities.
I think you, when you're playing with somebody else, no matter what it is, whether you're playing, you know, even in a full band, the trick is to find your part, and it's probably simpler than you think. As far as don't overplay, because if especially fingerstyle players that are used to playing everything, and in fact, people who are even people who strum, they're used to playing all six strings, and when you play them with somebody else, that may not be the right thing because it may just turn into a mess. So you want to try to come up with, it's kind of like being in an orchestra. You play your part, and the music is created by the way that all the different parts interact.
Yeah.
It's really helpful and, to think about it.
You know, one thing about like, in, you know, like for Doug and I, you know, we live an hour and a half away, so we don't get to get together as much as we'd like to. So the work you do on your own, it's really important to learn to be efficient with that. Like, you know, work out your part and work it out with a metronome and really play along with the recording that the other guy sent you. Because, you know, when you do get together, you don't want to, like, spend all your time just saying, oh, that didn't work. Let me come up with something totally different. So, you know, it basically comes back down to really efficient practicing, which usually means playing something you don't know. And just, you know, really be careful about working it out. Because once you get together, a rehearsal shouldn't be practice. So once you get together, you should be, you know, able to put those parts together, and they should basically work. You might have to work out some kinks, but they should basically work.
The flip side of that, though, is I know we had a few, at least, where we weren't getting anywhere until we got together and just sort of jammed on things. And it's like, oh.
Sure, okay. Yeah. It's a balance of the two. Yeah.
Sometimes it's a magic input.
You still there? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so that's definitely that.
So,
and there are some tunes that, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
There, you know, obviously some of the tunes we play as solo pieces as well, but then there's others that we really kind of reserve to the duet, just because the way that they were arranged, there really isn't that much of a part that works on its own there.
Got it.
I wouldn't play my parts on like the Torrega piece, for example. It's strictly strictly adding harmony lines and things.
Exactly.
So for folks who want to check this album out, what's the best outlet to, I guess everyone's asking this question about their favorite artists right now, but what's the best place to check this out?
Good. Oh, okay.
Bandcamp right now. Right now we're on Bandcamp, and there's a link. We have a website that's TejaandDougGuitar.com. So my first name is hard to spell for people. It's TEJA and DougGuitar.com. We will be on all the streaming platforms eventually, but we're giving it just a couple of weeks' time to kind of do some Bandcamp downloads and physical sales first.
Fantastic.
And, you know, we have a couple of videos out there. I think you saw them. One that's kind of about the project, and the other one where we talked about the 12 guitars that we did in there.
Yeah, that was cool. That was, like I said, I hadn't, a few of those were on my radar, and then a few were definitely not. So that was super interesting.
Yeah, so it was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah. What's new at Peghead Nation, Tia?
At Peghead Nation, well, we are continuing to put out great new courses. We recently launched another course with Sharon Gilchrist, a bluegrass mandolin fingerboard workshop, where she really kind of breaks down, you know, understanding the fingerboard for playing solos and everything and arrangements again. And that's just been really great. Matt Monasteri's course is doing really well for us. You know, we have so many amazing artists to work with that we're just really fortunate to continue to put out really interesting courses with people. Zoe Gigano just started a bass course with us recently, and that's been really fun to work with. And we have Wes Corbett doing a contemporary bluegrass banjo course. It's really quite amazing. So that's in addition to, I think we're up to 30 some courses now. And so yeah, we have a lot of fun with those. So yeah, and actually, if podcast listeners want to check out a month for free, we have a Fretboard Journal promo code. So
just, oh, you're on it.
To a Fretboard Journal, yes, so you can definitely get a month for free. Just enter it at checkout. The code is just Fretboard or lowercase.
Just Fretboard. All right. You will see many familiar faces from the pages of the magazine teaching there for the first time, like Matt Monasteri. Yeah.
Matt Monasteri. Yeah, on the guitar side, we have Matt. We have Scott Nygaard doing, several flat picking rated courses. Stevie Coyle's doing a fingerstyle course. I host a advanced fingerstyle course where I have a bunch of guest artists teaching tunes essentially, and that's a lot of fun. That one's a little bit on hold right now. We kind of figured we have 15 lessons in there and kind of keeping it at that for now, but we have Ed Gerhardt in there, Tim Sparks, Pepino D'Agostino, Adam Miller, Eric Sky has a lesson in there, Mary Flower, Tony McManus. Tony's also doing Celtic fingerstyle guitar course for us. And so we have a lot of great courses, and we plan to move ahead with lots more great stuff to come. It's been a lot of fun. For folks who don't know, it's me and Scott Nygaard and Dan Gable founded the company, and we've been at it for just over 5 years now.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
I remember when you were just thinking about this. Yeah.
Indeed. Well, I remember when you were just thinking about Fretboard Journal, Jason.
Wow. Well, guys, thank you so much.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for having us.
Indeed.
We'll send you some links and stuff to use. And can't wait to hear what we said.
The trick is never to listen to any interview you've done, but go for it. You can listen.
Okay. Good.
Well, thanks again. The album's called Duets, and I'll include a link in the show notes to the Bandcamp page and to Peghead Nation. But in these hard times, it did remind me, like, okay, good music transports you. It's a good thing. We need this. We need more of it. So
thanks Jason.